You know, when we study Old Testament history like we're doing this morning, you know, sometimes there's a question of, well, why do you study something like this? I mean, it's not got any instruction in Christian living like the epistles would. It's not really a study of the law that would be the foundation. Well, answer to that question is got a lot of factors into it. I mean, one of the things, all of the Old Testament is the story of God bringing about His scheme of redemption, His plan of salvation. Even when, as He's working through the kings and the judges, we're moving toward the salvation in Christ. Sometimes I personally think the book of Judges is largely there, not exclusively, but largely there just to help us better appreciate the futility of a life without God, a life lived in ignorance of God. The book of 1 Kings has that. It has other great character studies. But one of the points I wanted to emphasize, particularly at this stage of it, it drives home the fact that you reap what you sow. You know, Galatians 6 would say to us that if you sow to the flesh, of the flesh you reap corruption. You sow to the Spirit, of the Spirit you reap everlasting life. 1 Kings is going to show us a lot about how you reap what you sow. The second chapter that we've just gone through is Solomon is established as king. What do we see? We see men like Adonijah who reap what they sow. What did Adonijah attempt to do at the end of David's life? He tried to take over the kingdom, and it was not his. And so what price does he pay? Ultimately pays with his life. You know, it took steps as he asked for Abishag, Abiathar, a faithful priest for many years. But he ends up in exile because for whatever reason, and we're never told, he sided with Adonijah in this rebellion. And then there was Joab. Joab, a man that, you know, in many ways, he accomplished some great things for Israel. He helped with many great victories. And yet, he ends up executed because of his murders. And, you know, let's not ignore his part in the rebellion, but he had committed these murders. There was Shimei, who had cursed David. And it came back to him. It all came back to him. Well, today, we're moving in a little different direction as we look at the blessings given to Solomon. Yet, I want to tell you to watch. There are several things, particularly the very first verse of chapter 3 is going to plant a little seed of reaping what you sow. It's not, and to me this is fascinating how it starts. You know, we've established him as king. Then it says, now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall all around Jerusalem. Now, what happened there? There we go. Let's try this one more. There we go. Okay, right off this map is Egypt. The most powerful nation of that time. We'll be talking about this whole map later on. But early on, Solomon enters into an alliance with Pharaoh. And he cements this alliance by marrying the king's daughter. Those kind of alliances were not uncommon throughout history. In fact, you go back into Europe just a few hundred years ago, and there was an awful lot of that going on. Of course, you know, one of the ideas of that is if you have you've got this great power over here, and you're worried about them invading you and looting your city and burning it down. But if you have a bunch of his grandchildren living in the city, you know, what might happen? He might be a little more merciful. You know, by marriage alliances, you seek to provide security. That's a good strategy from an earthly point of view. But I want you to go back to Deuteronomy 7. Deuteronomy 7 will actually be quoted later when we come to 1 Kings 11. But these are the words of Moses just before Israel entered the promised land. You know, this is these are his last few months. He's delivering the sermons of Deuteronomy. And he says in verse 1, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger, greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly." You could make an argument, if you were Solomon, well, these verses actually only mention the nations of the land we were conquering. It doesn't say you can't go and marry someone from some other nation over here. By the letter of what's written, maybe. But what's the intent of Deuteronomy 7? To keep you from being influenced toward idolatry. To keep your children and, you know, so he goes and he marries a woman who is from one of the most idolatrous nations you could imagine. And it is just the beginning of what he will do. He will later marry all manner of women from various nations, and Deuteronomy 7 will be applied to that. But why does he need to make an alliance with Pharaoh? If he trusts the Lord, you know, trust in God. God has said, you're a holy nation. I mean, what he's doing is the kind of strategy everybody uses. But Israel's not everybody. And it will come, right at the very end of this book, we'll be looking at Jehoshaphat a little bit. Jehoshaphat was one of those guys, he was a good king. And he served the Lord, and yet he had a weakness for alliances with Israel. And would be rebuked for it, saying, you're allying yourself with the evil. Stay holy. But notice what's done here. He says it, tells us this, and then he leaves it alone. Now we're going to come back to it. I think he's just planting a little seed. You know, don't forget this. There's a foreshadowing here. We'll see more of this later on. We'll see more of Solomon in that weakness. But in the meanwhile, verse 2, that's the word. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. When we read about the high places in the Old Testament, what type of worship is usually associated with those? Idolatry. That's usually what you see. Here, and it's going to say at Gibeon, there was a great high place. It would seem that at this point, he's not talking about idolatry, but worship of the Lord. The tabernacle, when they had come into the land of Canaan, it seemed to have eventually resided at Shiloh. That came to be its location. In the days of Eli, you know, when Samuel, Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle was. Well, Jeremiah would later, we're not actually told what happened, but Jeremiah would say to the people who thought Jerusalem was secure because the temple was there, he said, you go look at what happened to Shiloh. So evidently it was devastated. The tabernacle, or at least what was left of it, was at Gibeon, about 6 miles from Jerusalem. The Ark of the Covenant is in Jerusalem. You know, you've got the Ark separated from the tabernacle. Likely the tabernacle is nothing like it was in the wilderness. You know, there's kind of a confusing time religiously. They had these high places that they worshiped the Lord, though the Lord had said, I want you to do your sacrifice at the one designated place. But what's the one designated place? Second Chronicles says the altar that belonged to the tabernacle was up in Gibeon. But the Ark of the Covenant that represents the presence of God, it's in Jerusalem. Things aren't just right. But Solomon goes up there. And I'm not going to turn over to 2 Chronicles. I hope you read from that. This was a big deal. Gibeon is not a very big place. It's a small village up there. But that's where the remnants of the tabernacle were. And Solomon goes up there with a great crowd. As if, I think, probably to celebrate his coronation. You know, him being made king. And how many offerings does he offer? Can you imagine that process of slaughtering 1,000 animals, having to skin them and prepare them, you know, and the burnt offering, you know, except for the hide and the entrails, would be burnt whole, you know, but what an offering. And this is a great occasion. Well, then that night, the Lord appears to Solomon in a dream and says, ask, what shall I give you? If Solomon had remained the same man he was this night, things would have turned out a lot differently. What a spirit he displays on this occasion. And Solomon said, you have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth and righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? Look at how he describes himself. He said, I'm just a what? A little child. Now, likely, as we've suggested, he's probably somewhere 16 to 20 at this time. That's not a little child, but this is a statement of humility. He said, I don't know how to go out or come in. I'm young. I'm inexperienced. And look at your people. What a nation I've been given. And he said, what I want most of all, Lord, is I want wisdom, an understanding heart, so I can judge this great people of yours. You know, it strikes me, the humility. The humility to recognize his need for wisdom. The heart, he describes himself to the Lord as your servant. But look at what he says, I want wisdom, an understanding heart, not to become famous, which he ultimately did. He became very famous. He said, I want this wisdom so I can judge your people. So I can be a servant to your people. You know, as God blesses us with whatever. It may be some talent. It may be financial blessing. Whatever it might be. God wants us to use it to serve others. And Solomon has that spirit right here. He said, I want to be able to judge this great people of yours. Because they are just, what a people they are. All right? Now, any thoughts, comments before we catch the Lord's response, which is encouraging? Well, this pleased the Lord, it says. The Lord was pleased with the speech. And God said, well, you could have asked. A lot of people would have asked for the lives of their enemies. They would have asked for great riches and honor. They would have asked to live this long life. He said, you didn't ask for those things. He said, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you riches. And I'm going to give you honor. And then he said, I'm going to give you one other thing if you are faithful to my commandments. And what was that? Long life. We're going to see Solomon become wealthy. You know, our expression, filthy rich, doesn't even begin to describe what Solomon's going to become. It's a mind-boggling wealth that he will accumulate. He will become famous. We're going to see at the end of the fourth chapter, people are traveling from all over to hear his wisdom. We'll read later about the Queen of Sheba. She said she'd heard about it. She wanted to see this. But the long life. How long will Solomon reign as king? 40 years. He'll reign every bit as long as his father. But he was probably at least 10 years younger than his father when he became king. I mean, the most you could stretch Solomon's age at this time to is 25, and I don't really think that works at all. Solomon probably didn't live to be past 60. He doesn't get the long life. Because God said, that's if, verse 14, you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments. The reaping what you sow, we won't see it yet. But we're going to see it in the life of Solomon. We're going to see that when we get to the end of this. And so, Solomon wakes up. And he goes back to Jerusalem. And what does he do? He goes and he offers more sacrifices. Verse 15, he offered up burnt offerings. He offered peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. Go to Leviticus 1 through 7 and read about the different offerings and the details and other places. And I'm not going to get into all of those. But one of the key differences is in a burnt offering, everything is consumed except for the hide, which was given to the priest. But with peace offerings, only a very small portion of this is burnt on the altar. When a man offered a peace offering, they would offer basically some of the fatty portions of the fat that covered the kidneys and some things. A portion was given to the priest, but most of the animal was then cooked and eaten. You ate the sacrifice after you had offered unto God his portion. And so the making these peace offerings, that and the feast, I think, go together. So we've got Solomon. It says at this point, he loved the Lord. You see him offering these sacrifices. You see him humbly requesting wisdom that he might judge the people. I mean, a lot of people would say, Lord, make me smart so that I can, you know, get into this college and I can get this job and I can do this or I can, you know. No, he says, make me wise and understanding so I can be a good judge of the people. Your people deserve this. And so, everything looks good right now. And will look good for a while. Let me stop there. Before we go into his famous demonstration of wisdom. All right. Who doesn't know the story of Solomon and the two harlots? I mean, that's one of those stories that a lot of people that don't know anything about the Bible have heard. You know, can I just step aside for one moment and say, biblical illiteracy, though, is on the increase in this country. I mean, it used to be, you know, that there were just a number of stories of the Bible that they were just common knowledge. Everybody knew them, even folks that didn't go to church. But if you ever watch a Jeopardy show and the Bible category comes up, typically there might be one of the three will just run that category. Because two out of the three have no clue. And it's usually not obscure stuff. You're thinking, I could get my fifth grader in here and they could probably answer these questions. And there'll be two people sitting there holding their thing like, you know, can we get to pop culture of the 80s? You know, we're ready to answer questions about Madonna, you know, not the Madonna, but, biblical illiteracy. But that's for another day. Here come these two harlots. Now, do you find it interesting that he just narrates a story about that involves two harlots that live in Jerusalem when what they're doing is in clear violation of the law? You know, they're living, but that's just the fact. They were there. You know, which tells you that, let's see, if two women are harlots living in violation of the law, you think you got some other folks living in violation of the law? You know, I mean, there's obviously, you know, there are people who are not living by the holy standards of God. But these two women come to him and they said, you know, one of them said, you know, she and I dwell together. You know, I'm sure they don't come and say we're harlots, but the historian knows this. And said, we both had children just 3 days apart, or, you know, on the third day after, you know, let it make 2 days difference. But said, we had these babies. And then one night, she rolled over on her baby and she smothered it and it died. And what did she do? During the night, while I was sleeping, she swapped babies and next morning I get up and I go to nurse my baby and I'm going, that's not my baby. Well, they didn't have the footprint from the hospital they could compare. There was no DNA testing. And the other woman sits, you know, you can just see her looking at Solomon like, that lady's crazy. You know, her baby died and she's wanting to take my baby away. And Solomon said, you know, he doesn't know. Now see, a woman would have studied that baby's face and tried to say, well, I think it's got mama's eyes and nose. You know, men look at babies and say, yeah, it looks like a baby. You know, I mean, in all honesty, men, how many times have you had the wife or somebody say to you, don't you see his daddy's nose and that? And you're going, no, I see the same nose on every baby in this nursery, you know. But, you know, Solomon looks, he says, you know, nobody could figure this out. You know, and so he says, look, here's an idea. You know, bring my sword. Bring a sword in here. He said, now, take and just cut that baby in half and give half and then everybody's got the same thing. Nobody's any different. And the mother of the living child, you can just see her speaking out immediately. No! Let her have the child. I'd rather her have it than, you know. And the other said, no, that seems fair. Neither one of us should have a child. And the king said, I can tell you who the real mother is. She's the one that reacted in horror. And everybody was like, wow, that's a pretty good way of figuring that out. And look at verse 28. All Israel heard about this. And they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. Do you find that also interesting? He said, they feared the king. You think, well, man, that's really impressive. You know, we'd clap and, you know, we'd say, wow. Then you go, we're not getting away with anything with this guy. This guy's going to figure things out. If, you know, and that, the word fear, you know, sometimes it has the sense of awe or, you know, high respect. And yet the word fear is used because it's not completely absent from that. You know, I think sometimes we deal with God, you know, it'll use the term feared God as synonymous with worship God. And we really just want to water that word down to the point where it doesn't mean anything more than, I just respect him. No. There were words he could have used for just if it's mere respect. Now, it's not hiding under the bed kind of fear. But people knew with Solomon now, you know, we're not going to pull anything over on this guy. He knows what he's doing. And the wisdom of God was in him. Later, what does Solomon say as the beginning of wisdom in Proverbs? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. He'll say in Proverbs, he'll say the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Solomon had the right attitude toward God. Now, God has given him wisdom, and he is richly blessed, the people fear him. Comments, questions on chapter 3. Before we get into the next list of people, I want y'all to memorize every single one of these. No, I don't. Chapter 4, the first 19 verses, they are one of those sections of the Old Testament history that probably loses a little of its luster to us, in that most of the names are people we're not ever going to read about again. You know, that, but it's important as it lays out. Solomon is blessed. Here's his administration. You know, this is how he set up things with wisdom. And it names some of his officials. I personally think 1 through 19 is kind of a stepping back later in his administration. Not that he sets all of this up, you know, 2 days after he has the dream. If you read through this list in chapter 4, you notice that in verse 11, that there was Abinadab in all the regions of Dor. He had Tapheth, the daughter of Solomon, as wife. And then you also have another one who, in verse 15, Ahimeaz in Naphtali, he also took Basemath, the daughter of Solomon, his wife. There's no way he has a daughter of Solomon, his wife, at the beginning of his administration. You know, sometimes they would marry somebody off pretty early, but at best, Solomon's got a toddler at this point. There are two things. One, it could simply mean that years later, well into his reign as governor, he married one of Solomon's daughters. Or it seems more likely to me that this is just, you know, down the road he's looking that Solomon realized the need to divide the land up and he made these men and he made these two men who were his sons-in-law. Gave them this job. You know, y'all think nepotism's a modern invention? You know, that they're two sons-in-law who are made governors. But the first six, it names some of the just folks that were part of his administration. Azariah, he was a priest. You know, names some of these others. Jehoshaphat, the recorder. Benaiah. We've already talked about, he's over the army. Notice verse 4, Zadok and Abiathar are the priest. Well, now that didn't apply for very long. You know, so, but it takes note that at least during part of that, they were over them. One, I want you to note, this is the kind of thing that the writer plants a seed. Adoniram, the son of Abda, over the labor force. We get to chapter 11 and 12, both those two chapters. That really comes into play. Do you remember when when Samuel was approached and they said, Samuel, you're old, your sons aren't like you, give us a king. And he was hurt, but God said, okay, it's okay. It's not really you they rejected, it's me. And he said, but you tell them, if you get a king, this is what he'll do. And there in 1 Samuel 8, he goes through all this. He said, he's going to take your daughters, and they're going to be servants. They're going to be cooks and bakers. Your sons, they're going to be workers. And, you know, you get a king, you're going to pay taxes. You know, you're going to have, they're going to tax you for labor. And he doesn't expand upon it here. But he says, these guys, this man is now over the labor force. You didn't have anybody over the labor force, probably, until now. Oh, they did projects from time to time. But what we're going to see under Solomon are just incredible building projects. And he's going to expand things, and he's going to make them a glorious kingdom. I mean, one, they're going to have that temple. But Solomon's going to build a great palace. And it's going to talk about other cities he builds, and his chariot cities and all. And you don't just get those things. They don't just happen. You know, so, you know, we've got the labor force, but just file that one away for right now. But verse 7, again, no complaints. But these 12 governors he talks about, these 12 leaders, what was their responsibility? They had to provide food for the king's household, every region. And basically, these probably approximate the old tribal boundaries, but they're not exactly the same, or else he would have just said of the tribe of Reuben, of the tribe of Gad, you know, of the half tribe of Manasseh, east of, you know, he doesn't do that. They had to provide for an entire month out of the year. Now you think about what this means now. You know, you're a little wheat farmer, got some sheep and all, and you're over here in the region of Judah. Well, not only do you have to worry about, you know, I got to feed little Simeon, you know, and I've got little Hannah that I've got to make sure I put enough food in her mouth. There's going to come a guy around that's going to collect some of my wheat to go feed those folks in Jerusalem that eat at the king's table. You know, 1 month out of the year, our region is responsible for feeding them every day that month. And when we get down to verse 22, it's not an insignificant amount of food. Now, this is probably not what it was day one of Solomon's reign, but this is what it comes to over time. You know, so we're beginning to see some things building. But I love how the writer, he doesn't wave the flag and say, hey, pay attention right here. This is going to be an issue later on. But he says these things. It doesn't, then when we get over to chapter 11, it shouldn't come out of nowhere and we go, oh yeah, I saw that. Actually, I saw that back in 1 Samuel 8. Because of what was said in 1 Samuel 8, when I got to 1 Kings 4, I should have, in my own mind, been waving the flag. Things are going to happen. So, he's got these men appointed. And, you know, these names, most of them are not significant to us other than, you know, they're named this one time. But look at 20. Actually, what I want to do, I want to read 20, 21, and then I'm going to jump to verse 24. Look at the prosperity. When they came to Samuel and they said, make us a king, they were getting whipped. The Philistines had encroached upon their territory. There were battles from others. They were suffering. But now look, Judah and Israel Isn't that interesting there? Judah and Israel? Aren't they just one nation? You know, it's already, he knows what's going to come about. There's a difference in them. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude. That's what God had promised Abraham. Your seed will be like the sand by the seashore, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Then verse 24, for he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river from Tipsa even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on every side all around him. The river, when it just uses the river, almost always it's the Euphrates that's up in here. Israel doesn't live in all of this, but it says he had dominion. The kings are paying him tribute. You know, here, from about the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, that's Canaan. You see what a great area they control. Then he makes mention, and I know it's a little hard for you to see. You can see it better on your map in your workbook. Dan, Beersheba. That's north to south. That's from Canada to Mexico. You know, in our 48 states. He says, from Dan to Beersheba, there was peace. Now, we get to chapter 11, we'll find that toward the latter part, it begins to deteriorate. But life is good right now. Life is very good, it would seem. They're prosperous. They're at peace. They're secure. That expression, under the vine and the fig tree, both Micah and Zechariah will later use that expression in reference to the time of Christ, to the blessings we enjoy in Christ. The picture is somewhat like in the old days when people sat out on the front porch. They weren't worried about crime. You know, they weren't holed up in the house with bars on the windows and locks on the doors. Everybody they sat out on the front porch drinking their iced tea, watching the world go by, and felt comfortable and secure. And he said, they're just sitting out. You can imagine, you've got the vine, you're sitting under it for the shade and the cool. You know, in the days before air conditioning, you know, I'm growing up, I spent many an hour under my grandparents' scuppernong vine. And I ate a few of those scuppernongs. Oh, did I eat a few of those. But it was cool. You know, it was a shaded place. Well, this is shade and security. And he said they had that. Life is good. And that's what really, he's going to build us up. And we're going to go through until we get to chapter 11. Life's good. But he's been noting all along little things that are all going to come to fruition. You can ignore God in your life. You can break his commandments. And it doesn't always happen immediately. You know, this idea of we reap what we sow, it's an analogy to farming. You know, you don't harvest immediately. Sometimes it's a long time. Life will be good and continue to be good for a time. But it's all going to come back to him in a little bit. I'm going to stop right there. In fact, bell's going to ring, I'm sure, any second now. Go back and pick up the food. I want you to really think about the amounts of food that are being talked about. And keep in mind, that's one day's. And you're living in a place, y'all got to supply that much for 30 days. You know, and it's not just you, of course, but your region. It began to be a heavy tax. We won't go into the next lesson. I know there's not a lot of this left. But I want to talk a little bit more about the wisdom of Solomon and some of the wisdom he recorded. So don't worry about going into chapter 5 for Wednesday night.